Welcome back, guys. Dave Barber Show, KMOX. So if you listen to the show at all, you know that I'm really into philosophy and science and physics, complete amateur at it, no degrees, no nothing like that. But I love learning about multiple universes and dimensions and the simulation theory. I can't get anyone to talk to me about it, so I finally found someone. Dr. Melvin Bobson is an associate professor of physics at the University of Portsmouth. He's the author of Reality Reloaded, The Scientific Case for a Simulated Universe. He joined us now. Melvin, very nice to meet you.
Hi, Dave. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. What I said in the intro is true. I love this topic. I'm incredibly interested in it. Let's pretend I don't know anything about it, and the people in my audience are just hearing it for the first time. We'll start at square one, and we'll build from there. So talk to me about what the simulation theory is.
So I understand you are a big fan of the simulation theory. Andrew mentioned this.
Yes.
So that makes one of us, at least. This is not a new idea. This is something that has been around for thousands of years, actually. It goes as far back as Plato, mm-hmm. 427 BC. The idea that we don't live in a base reality and our world is some kind of construct or a projection or a holographic sort of space. This has been around for a long time, and it evolved from ancient times, from Plato to modern times, especially with the emergence of computing technologies.
Yes.
And the quantum mechanics and the modern physics. It kind of morphed into something else, and it penetrated the pop culture, the media, movie industry, everything. Mm-hmm. It's something that everybody's familiar with this idea. What is different is that we are starting to build some scientific evidence for this. This is what is different today.
Yeah, if you think back to Plato and the men in the cave and watching projections against the wall, and they had very little technology, and now we're dipping our toe into artificial intelligence and quantum physics. What are we finding in the science, Melvin, that if we had never had a simulation theory before, would suggest that maybe there's something going on with that?
How much time do we have?
As much as you need, my friend.
So you very kindly mentioned my book. So in the book, I cover in good detail a range of physical facts that actually point very strongly to this hypothesis being a correct interpretation of what we see around us. The strong evidence I was trying to explain earlier that we are seeing today, scientific evidence, it comes from something that I developed about about 2 years ago, first article, and then in November last year, the second article. It's something to do with the behavior of the entire universe, something to do with the data optimization. It's not easy to explain in lay terms, sort of like. But what I observed a universal process that appears to permeate everything in the universe, even biological life, and it tends to compress information and minimize the information content. This is something that is only computers and computer programs do. So if the whole universe manifests in this way, one logical conclusion is that perhaps we are living in some kind of digital construct. But this is not total proof of mm-hmm. this of this idea. It's just one evidence. It needs further investigation, obviously.
Doc, would the conservation of information have to do with how similar it seems that some of the fundamentals of physics that, an object, a particle, an atom is different, whether it's observed or not? When you're not looking at it, it's a possibility wave. When you look at it, it takes form and it becomes something static. And as I understand it, I'm certainly no expert. I don't really even play video games, but as I understand it, if I'm in a video game and I'm riding a horse through the countryside and I look to my left, I see what's on my left. What's on my right doesn't exist. It doesn't exist until the game needs me to view it. And it seems that reality is a bit like that.
That's Dave, that's totally correct. You dotted the I there. It's exactly how it is. And I'm getting emails from very senior people in gaming industry, in Silicon Valley high-tech companies. They are seeing this all the time, and especially with the AI, the emergence of AI. I'm not going into details now, but especially in the gaming industry, they deploy this all the time. So nothing is rendered until you look at it, or you observe it, or you participate. And one example is if you have a live game that is played over the internet by thousands and thousands of users at the same time, the computational power is to render everything for all the users in real time is huge. So what they do, they actually do exactly what you described. Unless somebody is in that space, unless something happens, nothing is rendered. So they save, and this is what we learn from physics, from quantum mechanics. Okay, it's exactly what you said. The duality wave particle, okay, and then the double slit experiment, all these evidences we have, they point to exactly this process of optimization that we deploy in computer games, virtual realities, anything to do with computing. But I'm going to tell you something to your listeners that no scientist will ever tell you on live radio, okay? I'm going to tell you something because you mentioned AI, okay? So I'm not speculating. I'm not saying this is happening. This is the case. It's a possibility, okay? But let's assume for a second that we do live in a simulated construct, okay? The question is then, who is doing this, okay? And for what purpose? And everybody knows about AI nowadays. Everybody's familiar with the AI. And what I'm telling you now, no scientist will ever tell you, but what if the very Bible, okay, the Christian Bible, what if the Bible tells us that we live in a simulation? And in my book, I actually discuss, I came across this accidentally. I was just looking for some kind of small chapter to put at ease strong believers, religious people, Christians, and other denominations that would feel maybe threatened by this idea of being in a simulation, like their religious belief being threatened. And so I started to look at the Bible from this angle. And what I found evidence that actually the Bible itself tells us we live in a simulation. And I'll give you an example. The Gospel of John, it is like this. At the beginning, there was the Word, and the Word was with God, and God was the Word. Okay? Now, what does he mean that? If you replace Word with code, it is like this. At the beginning, there was the code, and the code was with God, and God was the code. In other words, we had at the beginning, and the universe began with a code. The code was with the creator, the God, and God was the code. In other words, God is an AI. So this is incredible. This is absolutely incredible. I sold a great deal of books around the world, and I had Muslim religious people emailing me. There is a particular one. He sent me pages and pages of quotes from the Quran, where he thinks it's exactly the same message coming from their Bible, from their religion, angle that actually tells them we live in a simulation. So this is incredible, and I'm not sure any scientist will come and say this and quote the Bible, but if I see this evidence, and if he's it links up so much with our the paradigm shift with the artificial intelligence and the things we are doing today, it's
It makes sense. It makes sense. I consider myself an open-minded, hopeful agnostic. I don't accept any of the major religions as being inspired word of God, but I'm open-minded to it. I could change my mind. But you're right. If my kids are grown now, but if my kids were small and I created a fort for them, building it out of blankets at the home and putting them over couches and such. I made it incredible, and you could walk in and you could look at it and you could clap your hands and say, "My gosh, look at this creation." Well, I created it. It started with nothing. The blankets weren't there. I've created something. So whether it's one of our ancestors in the future, I'm sorry, one of our descendants in the future who are creating this, which is one of the theories of simulation theory, or if it is a God, even the Christian or the Muslim God, if it was created, it's going to be artificial. And artificial to me means simulation, even if it maybe this is just as real as something can feel, but created is created.
It's exactly how it is. I see evidence of intelligent design everywhere. The universe is too perfect. Okay, so if you bring the idea that everything came about by accident and all the universal constants and all the perfection that we see in physics, in biology, all the things that click in place in a incredible precision. And if you think that this is just pure accidental, it's probability of this to be the case is almost almost nil. There appears to be some kind of intelligent design. I'm not speculating who is doing this, mm-hmm. what is God, what is, but I just found this incredible link between the Bible and artificial intelligence. And I had to say something about that, especially in my book.
So we're talking to Dr. Melvin Vopson. He's the author of Reality Reloaded, The Scientific Case for a Simulated Universe. So, Doc, your colleagues, whether it's the famous ones we see on the news or the not-so-famous physicists, philosophers, astrophysicists, is this something that people still talk about in hushed terms around the colleges, or is it becoming more mainstream?
Dave, to be honest, I see the duty of a scientist or academic is to publish the findings, our research, share it in the public domain, and it's a public duty. We are mostly funded by the public with public money, government funds and things like that, and it's a duty to actually publish it. And to be honest, any new idea in science has been met with a degree of reluctance. There was a pushback on anything new when Planck came up with the quanta of energy at the very beginning. He was so frustrated about this this claim. For 2 years, he didn't even attend the conference. He didn't publish anything. Because he was such an unusual. How can energy be quantized? The special relativity. When Einstein came up and said, "Hey, the time is quite relative. It flows differently depending on the observer, and it is not what you think." And all these weird things that science, the quantum mechanics, the non-locality, and all the things that we see in quantum mechanics, which are unusual. At the beginning, it was very hard to digest them, and this is what science brings about, all sorts of weird concepts and results, and very contradictory, and this is one of them, So I don't mind too much about what the community says and what they think. I feel this is a duty to actually publish the stuff and put it in the public domain. If it's wrong, so be it. That's how we make progress in science. If it's correct, then we have something to work on. But judging by the citations I get on this work, I don't think it has been received too badly. Actually, is going quite well.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. I was thinking the other day how here in America we have so much in politics and people being accused of being anti-science or questioning science. And I thought, well, questioning science is exactly what you do. And that's what exactly the job of a scientist is, to question the science that came before them and try to change it to get closer to the truth.
Well, exactly. And the thing is, the science is never settled. I mean, there was a time when classical mechanics, Newtonian mechanics, was believed to be all there is. There is nothing there. We understand everything, how things move, how... And then we developed relativistic mechanics. Then we developed quantum mechanics. And each time, the new theory didn't exclude the previous one. It just complemented, it added more substance, to afford, explanation of extreme cases in the quantum mechanics, the behavior of the very small things, subatomic scale and so on, relativistic mechanics, the behavior of objects moving at high velocities, and so on. But this is how science evolves. It's never settled. We always build new ideas, new concepts. We always make adjustments in science. I don't think, we need to question all the time and actually be open-minded.
The book, again, is Reality Reloaded, The Scientific Case for a Simulated Universe by Vopson, V-O-P-S-O-N. Doc, I can't wait to read the book, and this has been a pleasure.
God bless her. Thank you.
225 DGS on KMOX. Rachel boyfriend Kurt, of course, is a chef and involved in the food industry. And I thought of you guys. Today, we walked from here all the way downtown to our little Chili Max place and see the ladies start fighting.
Yeah.
Right? That's cool.
Right? That was fun.
Yeah.
But anyway, across the country, they say that everything in the food industry has changed because the business lunch is dead. That used to be the mainstay. Not dinners, not going out to Capital Grille for dinners. It was business lunches and business people and the three martini lunch and doing deals, and that it just doesn't happen anymore. I don't see it much here in St. Louis, but even in the bigger cities, more metropolitan areas, more densely populated, that people just aren't doing lunch out.
Makes sense. I mean, a lot of people are working from home, so why would you leave your work from home job to go meet someone for a business lunch? Mm-hmm. You'd probably just hop on a Zoom. Like, meetings, like, it's not just the lunch meeting, it's every meeting. And every meeting we have here, there's also the opportunity to get on Zoom. So you don't even have to physically be there. So it makes sense. By the way, at the beginning of the segment, when you said your boyfriend, I thought you were doing one of those things where it's like
too.
Your fake boyfriend. And I was like, oh, who's it going to be
too.
This
Here we
time?
Go. We've spent so long being
Rachel's boyfriend, Robert.
Yeah, Rachel's boyfriend, Kevin McCarthy. And so that's what I thought you were doing. And when
like,
you said
my actual boyfriend.
I was like, that. You know, that's her actual boyfriend.
Your boyfriend, Kurt.
You know, and we talked about, like, when we order food here, like, we order as much as we do, like, go out for a business lunch or whatever, or just, like, a team lunch or whatever it is.
Yeah, I wouldn't call what we do a business lunch.
You know
that's,
what I mean,
that's
though.
That's awfully
like,
generous.
But it's being, it's being
it's probably
at work.
As business lunchy as it gets, though.
Yeah.
Business lunchy as it gets for me. But we are at work, and, you know, we would go out to lunch at, like, you know, when there was, like, the Houlihan's at Union Station or whatever. And that is, I think, going away. And Dave, you and I talked the other day when I was DoorDashing. I used to talk to restaurants, and they would say, like, they don't actually really like being on DoorDash, but they feel like they, because DoorDash takes such a big cut, which means they have to charge more, which means people get the wrong idea about the restaurant. They think, oh, that place is expensive. When it's not, it's just that they have to inflate the prices because DoorDash is taking such a cut. And I was saying, like, they feel like they have no choice but to get on that.
It's changed so much, not just our eating habits, but a lot of people used to meet at work and now they're at home. I mean, there's so much of society has changed, especially with courting, I'll use that word, as far as meeting people, going to happy hours, like those things still happen, but none of them happen with the frequency or the regularity that they used to. 236 TGS and KMOX. Time to talk to Chet Pleben about the Donald Trump trial. Hey, Chet.
Hey, Dave.
Man, cross-examining Michael Cohen is like hitting a beach ball with a bat. I mean, my Lord, talk about a layup.
There's no doubt about it. You know, it really didn't take, as they said a couple of days ago, it didn't take a skilled cross-examiner to cross-examine him. But finally, after 16 hours over 4 days, we're finished. Now, how that's going to play with the jury is anybody's guess. I think, personally, although, again, we didn't hear the actual testimony, we have to rely upon what reporters are reporting. But I think it was just too long. Did they establish that he was a liar? He was cheated on his taxes. He was unethical. He was disbarred. Well, yeah, of course they did, without a doubt. But we knew that going in. And plus, this is Trump's lawyer. This is Trump's fixer. This is the guy that Trump retained and hired and did his bidding for X number of years, however long it was. And so I think, yes, did they establish that? Of course they did. Did they bloody his nose in certain areas? Yes, of course. But as you said, it's pretty easy to do. They had a lot of ammo. It's kind of interesting where they're going, and I think that they spent 16 hours trying to discredit him, but he admitted to a lot of that stuff, and it was kind of like, well, okay, just go ahead and believe what he's admitting as to his faults and as to his misconduct and his bad deeds, but don't believe that he's lying or believe that he's lying when he tells you the information that he did for Donald Trump and what he told Donald Trump about $130,000 misappropriation or payment to Stormy Daniels to keep her mouth shut. So I think that at the end of the day, Both last week at the end, almost at the end of last week, and I think today, right before they finished, they hit on two things that I think really impacted at the time, impacted his credibility. And I was kind of anxious to see what the prosecution would do on redirect to rehabilitate him, because they get that chance after the cross-examination is completed. Mm-hmm. And so the two areas that I think that they hit on was the telephone call that he claims that he made to Donald Trump on October the 24th. And what he claimed last week is that he couldn't reach Trump, so he tried to get a hold of his bodyguard, which was a Mike Schiller. And so he contacted Schiller, and Schiller was with Trump at the time, and Schiller handed Trump the phone, and that's when he said, on direct examinations a week or so ago, that's when he told Donald Trump about Stormy Daniels, that was taken care of, and things were all set up, not a problem. The difficulty with her was over. Well, when they cross-examined him, with some documentation, I believe some text messages, that indicated that really what he was talking about at that point in time, and what he wanted to talk to Schiller about, not to Trump necessarily, was that there was some telephone calls that he was receiving, threatening telephone calls, and he wanted to talk to Schiller to see if he could do something about that. And they made it sound like it was just Schiller that he was talking to, and it was not Trump that he talked to, and therefore he did not talk to Trump about anything related to Stormy Daniels and the payment to Stormy Daniels. So what the prosecution did was redirect him on that, and he stood firm. Clearly he stood firm. And they tried on cross to say, well, wait, you had all these telephone calls. How could you remember this one? And he stood firm. He said, I remember this telephone call. Notwithstanding what you're showing me, I remember that telephone call. And so what they did on cross was reaffirm that, of course. But then toward the end of the afternoon session, they also said that they came up with some video, a CNN video, that shows that Trump was at some talk that he was giving, some campaign stop, and he was with Schiller. And the video actually shows him with Schiller, which then corroborates what Cohen was saying as that being the time that he actually talked with Donald Trump, certainly at least talked to him, and that Schiller actually handed the phone to Trump, and they had a communication. And of course, the cross said, well, wait a minute, that telephone call with Schiller was only a minute and 28 seconds. Not enough time for you to go ahead and talk to Trump about the Stormy Daniels situation. So that's about a 96 seconds or more. There's a lot that can be said in 96 seconds. And of course, Trump's on his way out the door, I think, with this campaign stop that he was making. And all he needed to say was everything's taken care of. So how long can that possibly take? And on closing argument, what the prosecutors may very well do is take that 96 seconds, stand there, and tell the jury, here, let's count off 96 seconds, and let's see what we can talk about during that 96-second period of time.
Have I ever told you my story, Chad? This is going to send a chill up your spine. When I was a first-year baby lawyer, we were representing a healthcare program, a healthcare company. And you know how it is when you're billing, you bill like tenths of an hour and things like that. And I had billed 10 or 15 minutes for a letter that I wrote to the client. Hey, just find included here the deposition of, Chet Pleben, blah, 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 blah. All the best. Sincerely, Dave Glover. And the problem was the client had been an associate at my firm, and they hired her away. And she knew good and GD well. It didn't take me 15 minutes to dictate that. And she called me and she said, hey, Dave, you know, I like you, but you charged me 15 minutes for this letter. I would like you to read this letter And then I would like you to remain silent for the remainder of the 15 minutes. And she held my feet to the fire for about three. And after that 3-minute silence, I'm like, I apologize. She's like, point made. But that's what I was thinking. Be silent for 96 seconds and let people fill it. Yeah, you could do that.
Oh, it sounds like an eternity. And I've done that, and I had it done to me. And it truly sounds like an eternity. I mean, you're clicking off every second, like it's an hour per second. I mean,
Chad, let me ask you the ultimate question here, which is, you paid about as close of attention as anyone I know to this case. If they give it to the jury next week and they come back with an acquittal or they come back with a guilty verdict, either way, will you go, fair enough, I can see how you got there, or would you feel that one way or the other was a miscarriage of justice?
No. Either way, I can understand that. The problem that I would have, because it's very hard, you know, it's very difficult for me to follow as a lawyer, and I kind of know, you know, what's going on. But again, you know, I don't see this stuff, so I have to rely upon what reporters report. But you can imagine jurors, notwithstanding the two lawyers that are on the jury, but just regular lay people who are thrown into this and perhaps never served on a jury in their entire lives, never been in a courtroom in their entire lives. So you can imagine them putting together piece by piece by piece the various pieces of evidence that are applying to this case. Obviously, the prosecutor has one point, the defense has another point. And these lawyers that are defending Trump, I mean, they're clever, and they're trying to lead these jurors down the primrose path and trying to suggest certain things, like suggesting that he never even had a conversation with Trump and just talked to Schiller on that particular occasion. Now, this video will rebut that. So they're taking notes. But again, and the court will instruct them, you can take those notes back into your deliberation with you. But that's not the best evidence. The best evidence is, you know, what your recollection is. And so trying to put all this together is very difficult over this extended period of time. Trying a case this long is very, very difficult over this period of time. And so a lot of this case, in my opinion, and I generally don't say this, but in a case that's this long and this complicated and this intense, I think that the closing arguments are going to set the tone for what's going to happen back in that during the course of that deliberation.
I get that.
Yeah, and I think all of this was all the cross-examination over this period of time was designed to lead up to that. And all of the prosecution's evidence was designed to, they knew that Cohen was a liar and was going to be characterized as a liar, and everything that we knew he was going to be actually happened. And I think that's why they wanted to lay a foundation for all those other witnesses and indeed all those other documents. And I think at the end of the day, though, I don't think that they have touched not a single thing. The smoking gun of the $130,000, which is the heart and soul of this, and the Exhibit 35, which is Weisselberg's own notes of repaying Michael Cohen $130,000.
It's going to be really, really interesting. Chad, we can't thank you enough for paying attention for us, and we'll talk to you soon.
You bet.
Welcome back to 252 DGS. We have Tom Ackerman joining us at the top of the hour to talk about the Cardinals. So, Andrew was trying to do a bit. He talked last week about having this cane sword, a cane with a sword inside it, and he brought it today, and he thought, I'm just going to hold it, and then Dave's going to go, what's that? And then he'll pull it out, like with a flourish, except that he was holding it in such a way that I couldn't see it, and so the whole bit just, now he's trying.
I don't like him brandishing that thing.
Why?
Because you're holding it too close to your face, and I'm worried you're going to cut your face.
It's not sharp. Well, the master swordsmiths in Edwardsville, Illinois, at the strip mall did not take a heavy enough whetstone to this.
On the break, Andrew's like,
the Hattori technique.
Here's exactly how it went with the exact inflections. Andrew said to Rachel, "Rachel, would you like to hold the sword?" And Rachel goes, "No, thank you. No, thanks."
I'm good on the sword.
I'm good.
I mean, I do think it's cool, especially if I would have been like 12, 13 years old. First of all, I loved canes. I don't know why. I always wanted like a umbrella that you could also use as a cane, like with the curved handle. I mean, I do think it is neat. But I don't know. And now that I'm in my 30s, I don't need
to very 12-year-old boy.
Hold it myself. Yeah.
So this was confiscated from me
from my
home by my own mother, if you can believe it.
Wow.
She did not want me to have the blade.
She knew you.
I tried to convince her that it wasn't a sword, but it's pretty obvious when you unscrew it and pull the sword out that it is a sword in there. And so when I found this when I was going through some of my mother's stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Day after.
She really did confiscate it.
Oh, yeah. It was in a closet in my grandmother's old bedroom, which was just sort of a storage room at this point. And it was
Grandma
under some blankets and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found this. It felt like it did feel like uncovering like an ancient blade heirloom. Like I found it in there, and I was like, oh, "It's the cane sword."
Well, you got the last laugh on that one.
I thought it had gone. I thought it was gone for good. And man, let me tell you, you could not take this thing out of my hands.
Now I don't wish you
for about
ill,
the whole week and a half.
But if you did cut yourself a little bit with it.
It would be very funny. It would be sort of like when you were kind of... Have I told you the story of the world's sharpest knife that you gifted me?
No.
So there is a hole in the world's sharpest knife so that you can put your finger through it while you're cutting, and it lowers the risk of you cutting your finger with it because it is incredibly sharp, and it comes incredibly sharp right out of the box. It's the world's sharpest knife. And so I was doing tricks with it and spinning it.
As you do with the world's sharpest knife.
As I was doing, because I was... My wife was very upset that I was doing that because she's like, you're going to hurt yourself. And I'm like, no, I'm not. And here, I will show you, and I'm going to do this until you're comfortable with me doing it. And so I'm flipping it and doing tricks
like
and things.
Exposure therapy.
Strange man.
I cut myself so bad. You.
Well, this is after he was doing it in front of us, and we told him to stop, too.
I spun that thing around, and it sliced my finger.
It's like when I gave you the fancy watch.
Uh-huh. And there was blood everywhere.
Jeez.